So I want to thank Ariana and Wendy in particular for hosting this. And I was going to tell a short story here because I finally learned how to sell books in bookstores like this. Last fall, I was doing a bookstore in Cody, Wyoming, Legends Bookstore. And the woman who owns it, Teresa, knew it. Said, well, you know, if you come the day before, you can do a radio show with the great Russ Francis. And some of you guys knew Russ Francis was a great tight end for the for New England Patriots and the San Francisco 49ers and won a Super Bowl. And that's why I did a two-hour radio show with him. And he's this great big guy. He's like 6'6", 250, still at his playing weight. He puts a cowboy hat on, so, you know, he's about 7 feet tall, and he's always packing. He's got a gun on his hip. So I did a two-hour radio show with him, and the next day I went in this bookstore to sign books, not to give a talk like this, but just to sign books. And everybody who came back to me was buying a book, and that never happens. You know, usually if one out of every five or six people talk to you buys a book. That's a lot. And then I finally found out, well, Russ is meeting him at the door with his gun in his hat. And for women and smaller people, the gun's like at eye level. And he's telling everybody to go back and buy one of Keith's books. Eat one of his cookies and buy one of these. So I figured, now I know how to sell books. You just bring Russ Francis with him. Or gun. Right. Anyway, I'm going to actually look at notes occasionally because some of you have heard me talk before and don't want to hear all my sad stories about being a survival editor and all that for Field and Stream. But I came across a saying. This was on the refrigerator at my mom's house. If you can see the path laid out before you step by step, it's not your path. Your path you make with every step you take. And I forget who said that. But I realized, well, that's the way I have to write books because I can't outline books or do anything along those lines. My mind just won't do that. So what I have is I'll have a beginning for a book and sometimes an end and sometimes sort of a theme that runs through it. And in the middle, all I do is keep taking these steps, which usually aren't in the right direction, and I got to go back and do it all. So anyway, I have to tell you that this book, which is my sixth book, Cold Hearted River, it started... I had an opening scene in my head, and I had sort of a device to propel the book forward, which sort of fell in my lap. And so somebody just said they liked the first chapter of this book. Well, that story actually came from my own life or my own experience as a survival editor of Field and Stream. I talked to these two guys, and they were elk hunters in Idaho, and they were caught in a blizzard. And they thought the only way they could survive was to shoot their horses and crawl inside. But they couldn't shoot their own horses, so they shot each other's horses. And they survived the night. And when they woke up the next morning, the sky cleared and they could see their truck. And so I'd always wanted to use something along those lines to start a book. And although that's not the way I start this book exactly, That was the little thing that got me started. The other sort of device I had to sort of propel this book forward, it also came from my life, and to me it was much more interesting. I started working for Field and Stream magazine way back in the 1970s, and somebody else who was a contributing editor at the same time was Jack Hemingway, Ernest Hemingway's oldest son. And Jack liked to fish on the Thompson River in British Columbia, where I did. And so our paths would cross now and then. You know, maybe over the course of 3 years, I fished together with him four or five times. And together is really not the right word. We would follow each other down a run and change places and keep fishing. And one day we were at a place called the Graveyard, which is actually, there is a graveyard just up the hill where all the graves face north. And you could always tell if Jack was on the river because he was always whistling. He whistled all the time. And he liked to fish alone. And for some reason, this is a very famous steelhead run, but Jack and I were the only ones that fished it from dawn until dark. And on towards dark, he hooked a steelhead, and I helped him land it down at the tail out of the run. And my dad at that time would always carry a little flask with hot chocolate and schnapps in it. And so I had that. And so Jack and I sort of toasted this great fish he caught, which was 15 or 16 pounds, pretty good fish. And so I'd never spoken to him about his father because Jack was his own person, and, you know, you don't want to, you know, he was actually probably a better fisherman than Ernest was, at least in freshwater. But I sort of worked up my courage, and I said, well, do you think your dad would have liked this kind of fishing? By which I meant, you know, freezing, falling in slick rocks, and lucky to catch a fish once every week or so. And first he said something, just sort of tossed it aside. He said, well, my dad liked to say that all true stories end in death. I think you'd have liked the idea of fishing in a graveyard. But then he said, and I don't know, I can't, it's been a long time, but more seriously, he said that his father would have enjoyed this kind of fishing, but he had lost all interest in fly fishing for trout or steelhead when all his valuable gear was stolen from Railway Express, stolen or lost. He had just moved to Ketchum, Idaho in 1940, and the tackle never made it. And I didn't think about that story for 25 years or more. But then Gail, my wife who's sitting right here, who's a reporter for the Bozeman Chronicle, she went down to northwest Wyoming where Ernest Hemingway had stayed for five long summers and falls, starting in 1930 and ending in 1940. And it's sort of one of the lesser known times of his life. And but he wrote parts of several great novels there, including For Whom the Bell Tolls, and some of his more famous short stories. And she said, well, you know, not too many people know about this. You should put this in one of your books. And I remember thinking, well, I have this story that Jack told me years ago, but I couldn't really remember it real well. I mean, I remembered what he said, but I couldn't remember about the steamer trunk or exactly what was in it. So I spoke to Patrick, Ernest Hemingway's second son, and in fact, I talked to him just a couple weeks ago, but I also spoke to him about a year and a half ago about it. And he said, yes, he remembered it quite clearly, and that what was in the steamer trunk was a lot of very fine tackle from the Hardy Brothers in London. And that he could remember that his father had a devil of a time, as he put it, translating pound sterling into American dollars. And he said, you know, it's really a tragedy about that because he never fished again for trout. He only fished again one more time in the Big Wood River in Idaho, and I think that might have been for a photo opportunity for a magazine. So I decided, well, you know, I'll do this, but I was reluctant at first because I had a character who sort of tries to summon the soul or the spirit, if not the pen, of Ernest Hemingway. And I thought, well, you know, that's sort of a recipe to be made a fool out of or make a fool out of yourself. And the other thing was it was sort of like a day of the jackal syndrome, as I call it, where everybody in France knows that Charles de Gaulle was not shot by a sniper. But the book was good anyway because the author was able to pull it off. Well, to my knowledge, nobody has ever come up with the steamer trunk of lost fishing tackle of Ernest Hemingway. But it's out there somewhere. And so I was able to travel to Michigan, where Hemingway spent time, to Cuba, and of course to northwest Wyoming. And somebody who helped me a great deal in this was Valerie Hemingway, who was here, who was Ernest's great friend and personal secretary during the last couple of years of his life. And she was able to get me in his home in Cuba and actually proofread the book, and so any mistakes are my own. So I have a little fly here, and this I wanted to present to Valerie. You know, I make these little flies that are on either the cover or the inside cover or the spine of the book. They usually have something to do with the book. Well, I call this one Papa's McGinty because the old McGinty wet fly was Ernest Hemingway's favorite fly, which he wrote about quite a bit, actually. So I'm going to show you this and give it to Valerie, if you'll let me. So do I have time to read for 5 minutes? Is that okay? And the only reason I really don't like to read in most places, but because this has something to do with fishing and Hemingway, I thought I would read something that had to do with fishing and Hemingway. You know, I usually only get to write one or two fishing scenes in each book. People think I write fly fishing mysteries. Actually, I write one or two scenes in each book. They actually have roundtable discussions at Penguin Books about, you know, how many scenes I should have and how many I shouldn't. No, really. Anyway, this is a chapter called Secrets, and I'm going to skip the first couple of pages. And so Sean is fishing at night on the Madison River, smoking a pipe that his father had. Sean brought the pipe stem to his lips. He glanced at the luminescent hands of his watch. Midnight. When the hearth fire in the clubhouse had burned down, and they had, at least for the evening, exhausted the subject of Ernest Hemingway, Sean had found that he could not fall asleep in the club's bunkhouse. Typically, he slept quite well there, soothed by the lullaby of the river outside the window. But he could not sleep, and so he had risen and found himself at the water's edge. Above him, a sickle moon reflected on the surface, which just beyond its arc, a single shimmering star. The pipe lit, its cherry bowl glowing, Sean regarded that star. He had a feeling, it had been building since he'd come back down the mountain with Martha, that he was about to embark upon a journey. It had happened before when a seemingly insignificant detail took on a life of its own. This time it was a three-fly cast on a leader made from catgut and a fly wallet's curious, if tenuous, connection to the most famous of American writers. Before this evening, Sean's knowledge of Ernest Hemingway had been sketchy, if specific. In a high school literature class, he'd been given the choice of reading The Great Gatsby by F. Scott Fitzgerald, Light in August by William Faulkner, or A Farewell to Arms by Ernest Hemingway. He'd asked the teacher if he could substitute Hemingway's In Our Time, because several of the stories were set in Michigan, where he'd once gone on a camping trip with his father. Sean had chosen the volume because it was thin, and his teacher's face, as she pondered the request, told him that she suspected as much. Nonetheless, she agreed. Most of the stories in the volume Sean skimmed and promptly forgot, but two had made indelible impressions. The first was Big Two-Hearted River, which Sean liked immensely as a fishing story, unaware until he read the cliff notes that it was the subtext that gave it gravity, a young man shell-shocked by war, trying to find solace in the constancy of a river, and who, by attending to ritualistic chores such as chopping wood and pitching a tent, could reclaim a sense of who he'd once been. The story left Sean with a series of images, trout holding in the current among mists of sand and gravel that spurted from the stream bed, the slow bubbling of pancake batter in a frying pan, the coffee, according to Hopkins, which Sean tried to make and found terribly bitter, the sudden flame of a match incinerating a mosquito on the ceiling of a tent. Sean had tried that trick the next time he'd gone camping with his father, who was not pleased by the hole the match burned in the canvas of his tent. The second story was Now I Lay Me, which followed the long night of a soldier who was afraid to fall asleep, feeling that if he did so, the soul would fly out of his body. He passed the hours of darkness by fishing trout rivers in his mind, starting at a point upstream and fishing them all the way downriver, then turning around and fishing them back to the place where he'd started. Sean did not fear for his soul, but he did identify with the soldier, for he too found sleep elusive and had often lain in a half-waking state, fly fishing his way through currents both recalled and imagined. Usually those streams were real waters that he had fished, like the Deerfield and Battenkill rivers in Vermont and the Ausable and Manistee rivers in Michigan. But sometimes he made them up. And if you were to ask him when he had first seen the Madison River, his favorite trout stream in the world, he would have said not until his early 30s after he moved west. But that was not entirely true. He was only a boy when he'd seen a photograph of the Madison in an old Field and Stream magazine. He had torn the page out and taped it to his wall, and at night he would fish that river, from a point far upstream where the river was small and the mountains tall, and reaching the stretch where the photograph was taken, he would fish it all the way downriver, from peaks to plains, until its currents joined those of the Gallatin and Jefferson Rivers to become the Mighty Mo, the Missouri River. This was very curious, even surreal, for there were stretches of the river that, when he actually saw them for the first time, he would swear he'd fished them as a boy. In fact, he'd never been within 1,500 miles of Montana. Thus, the river of his mind joined currents with the river of geography to become a river both real and unreal, and that as a consequence was his and his alone. He knocked out the ashes of the pipe and touched the bottom of the bowl to the water's surface to cool it. He placed it back in his vest and began to fish, swimming a mouse fly with a strip of muskrat for a tail through the apron of smooth water that pooled below a log jam. He did not expect to be rewarded with a fish. As a rule, strikes are few when night fishing, fewer still when the water is cold, but big trout don't get that way by following rules. This one took violently and crashed the surface, shattering the reflection of the moon and scattering the stars. By the time the trout had quit jumping and was pulling away, Sean stumbling after it, it had taken almost his entire fly line. When he finally got enough control to keep it from wrapping line around exposed rocks and breaking the leader, he was so far downstream that he could make out the silhouette of the clubhouse. For a long moment, he thought about calling out, for even without seeing the fish, he knew from the way it fought that it was an old hook-jawed brown trout, and that it was probably the largest he had ever hooked in the Madison River. Willoughby and Winston would surely like to see it, and he would like to see the expression on their faces when they did. But he did not call out, although when he finally slipped his hand under its belly and switched on his headlamp, he saw that the trout was not only the biggest he'd caught in the Madison, but the biggest he'd caught in any river. As a form of crude measurement, he held his hand against the cool, underwater feel of it. He walked the hand down the length of the trout from its lip to its tail, 3.5 turns, about 27 inches, perhaps 8 pounds, perhaps 9. His spots were the size of Canada dimes. He removed the hook and supported the fish with a hand under its belly, his head into the current so that the water worked across the gills that shone regularly in pulsing red ellipses. He opened his hand and the trout settled to the bottom, where it wavered indistinctly in the smoky current, regaining his strength. He thought of Nick Adams watching the trout on the stream bed in Big Two-Hearted River, the fish as much shadow as reality. Then the trout was gone. Sean clipped the deer hair mouse, which had been mangled by the trout's teeth, and found a compartment for it in one of his fly boxes. He would never fish it again, but keep it to serve as a reminder that the trout had actually existed. Though having been caught in a river that was both real and imagined, the fish itself was suspect, and Sean wondered if he might someday wonder even about that. He knew that he could sleep now and slowly walked the bank back to the log house, the star that danced outside the sickle of the moon showing the way. In the morning, when Willoughby handed him coffee and asked him how his fishing had gone, Sean only smiled. Rivers, dreamed and undreamed, had always acted as mirrors in his life, showing him his reflection while keeping their secrets, at least those that had spots the size of dimes. He knew that he'd been afforded a rare glimpse beneath the surface, and being as superstitious as the next angler, he wondered what he'd done to deserve it, and whether talking about it would prevent it from ever happening again. He decided to keep the secret of the trout. No one would have believed him anyway. So that's that. So that's like the only fishing scene in the book. So now you don't have to. Anyway. So I'll pass this to Christine. One of the nice things about doing this is you get to do it with very nice people like Christine, because this is sort of a lonely job, but it's also sort of a mine kind of thing where you're constantly going places trying to draw attention to yourself, which I'm really uncomfortable with. So it's really nice to have somebody else around.
Thank you. That was beautiful. the reading. And thanks for the introduction. It is nice to have you, Keith, especially a local here in Bozeman. I feel like a parasite, but I'm happy to be here. And, you know, I'm also going to steal your quote. What's your quote?
I didn't write it down.
Oh.
Passing?
Yeah. Well, anyway, I don't actually have to read it, but it just reminded me not so much of like my process for writing, although it's very similar. It reminded me of my life, like just from the little introduction that you got. You know, I'm all over the board with going to Embry-Riddle, and getting a master's in English and doing lots of different things in my life. And I had a hard time kind of finding my way. It was never clear. And so I had to just take one step at a time in terms of finding that way. Yet through that process, I have another quote, and I'll probably butcher it because it's not written down, but it's by Steven Spielberg, and he says that your dreams don't shout at you, they whisper to you. And throughout that whole process of kind of trying to figure out what I was doing in the world and in my education and jobs and things like that, I always had this little tiny whisper that I wanted to write. And I was very nervous about writing because I didn't have the confidence, for one thing. I had this kind of, approach avoidance kind of thing going on with books in general for a long time in my life, because when I was in third grade, my third grade teacher said that I could not read. She actually called my parents in and said, "We want to hold her back. She can't read." And my dad said, "Well, she can read. You just make her stand up in front of the whole class and read. And she's really shy." And I was terribly shy. Probably still I am a little bit, but I've kind of gotten over that over the years. But I had trouble because that back then, and I actually had trouble in math too, because my teacher used to make me stand up and do the dreaded times tables. What's 8 times 7? What's 7 times 5? Really quick, and I'd freeze, and I was like a deer in the headlights, and I couldn't answer because I was so nervous. But that happened to me with reading, but she was actually correct. I did have a little bit of trouble reading back then, and it wasn't like I had dyslexia or anything like that. It's just I was the youngest child, and I'm not blaming my mom, but I don't think I got read to a lot. And I think, you know, any of you who have children know it's really important to read to your kids when they're young. And but when that teacher told me that I couldn't read, it was like this weird thing that just stayed in my subconscious forever. And of course, I did learn to read and I did tackle that. In fact, I'm actually kind of stubborn and bullheaded. And if somebody tells me I can't do something, I want to do it even more. And it's kind of ironic that in third grade, I was told I couldn't read. And then I end up getting a master's in English, later in my adult life. And so, but through that time, with this whole thing with books and all this kind of turmoil going on with whether I even had the confidence to sit down and read when I was young, much less write as an adult, it's just this thing that I had to tackle. But I had this whispering kind of dream going on that I wanted to write stories. And I went to school out in the Seattle area, and I would drive back and forth and think of stories. And one day I was teaching at Flathead Valley Community College in my area up in Kalispell, and I looked at between classes, I looked at the catalog, and there was this class offered for write your first novel. And I thought, well, that sounds interesting. I'm going to take this class. And it was just a community ed class, and I took it, and the whole goal was to write your first 30 pages. And so I did that, and I got my first 30 pages down, and then I wrote another 30 and another 30 and another 30, and it took me 4 years, but I finished my first novel. I never did anything with it. It was not a crime fiction novel. It was a non-genre kind of novel that I was hoping would be like an Oprah Book Club pick. And that didn't happen. But I put it aside, and then I thought, well, maybe that was just a practice novel. And back then, it was getting an agent was like the whole snail mail thing, where you had to type the letter out, put it in the mailbox, and send it, and wait, and go to the mailbox, and get the rejection letter. It was like this awful, hideous process. And for this person who had low self-esteem in terms of all that, anyway, I was like, this is not for me. This publishing process is just too daunting, and I don't want to be rejected. You know, Stephen King has this horrible story about having a stake with all, you know, in all his rejection letters up on his wall. And I'm like, I don't even want to do that. And so so I didn't really spend that much time trying to get an agent or doing anything. I just dabbled with it a little bit. Wrote a second book instead, which took me 2 years instead of 4 years. And that was a non-genre book as well. And then I ended up not doing anything with that either because I ended up going through a divorce and I had a little boy and I kind of went into survival mode and I took about a 10-year break from writing because I just, not from writing. I actually did a ton of writing. It was just, technical writing and it was very monotonous and I didn't have the energy or the juice to sit down at the computer at the end of the day after doing a lot of technical writing and sit down and, you know, approach something like a novel. And so I took a long break from it, but that whisper just wouldn't go away. And, you know, long story short, I got involved in the whole Pilates thing. And, you know, there was that pun about I got the flexibility to go back to writing. And that is exactly what happened. I think once I got away from the technical writing and being at the computer all the time, I was able to listen to that whisper. And I got back into writing. And so I decided I would write what I felt like I knew and was comfortable with, and that was my area. And my area is home of Glacier National Park. It's a gorgeous place. I love it. I've hiked many, many miles in Glacier and just adore the area. And the whole area that I live in is a beautiful area with many lakes. A lot of you have probably been to the Flathead. Lots of lakes, lots of, you know, right up next to the mountains, and if you're on the north end of it, which is where I am, near the Whitefish Range. And so I set my first book there. It's called The Wild Inside, and it takes place in Glacier National Park, and it features a lead detective from the Department of the Interior who is called in to investigate a pretty serious crime that takes place. However, Glacier's the last place he wants to be because when he was, I think, 14... it's been a couple years now. His father was attacked and mauled by a grizzly bear, killed by a grizzly bear while they were camping there one night. So he has these kind of haunting memories about Glacier, and he has to go back there and solve a crime. And the book is about as much about the detective and how he battles some of his past trauma and all that as it is about solving the case. And I tend to enjoy books that have a protagonist that has a lot to kind of work through as well as the case that they're working through. And so my second book is actually, and in doing that, where I work through the protagonist, I kind of play out their character arc to some degree. And so I felt like I was done with Ted, who is the main character of this book. And I don't know if I'm done with him forever, but I felt like I was done with him at the time and that I couldn't write a second book about him. So what I did is I plucked a secondary character out of this book and he becomes my lead in this book. It's called Mortal Fall. And this also takes place in Glacier National Park. And in this book, I have a protagonist that was a side person that was in both of these books. She's a forensic scientist for the Flathead County. And this is my last one. It just came out in June. It's called The Weight of Night. And she actually has quite the backstory herself. She's got a sleep disorder, and it's kind of problematic. And I wish I had, you know, like this thing that I, like the Hemingway story that I could share with you, but it really wasn't that way at all. It's just, I saw this article on Twitter, of all things, I think, you know, and I just clicked on it, and it was this article about all these people that have actually committed murder in their sleep, in reality, like, because there's this awful sleep disorder, it's called parasomnia, and quite a few people have it, and, you know, the lesser degrees of, it's just sleep walking taken to this kind of absurd level. A lot of people sleepwalk, but most people, you know, don't take it to the levels that people who have parasomnia have. And that is, they have this situation where they've got this shortage of a hormone in their body, I think it's dopamine. They don't have enough dopamine that, actually, I may be wrong about that. So don't quote me. I'm not a doctor. But they don't have enough. It's in my book, and I researched it, but I've forgotten it now. But they're lacking us. I think it's dopamine. And what happens is they get paralyzed at night. Unless you're a sleepwalker, get paralyzed at night when we sleep. And so we don't act out our dreams. But somebody who has this does not have that proper chemical reaction that prevents them from getting up and acting out the kinds of things that they're dreaming about. And so the article that I read described some poor guy, I think in England, who actually strangled his wife because he thought she was a demon. I mean, he was dreaming about a demon, and he thought there was this demon in the room, and this is real. And he woke up and she was dead. I mean, he had strangled her. And it went to court, you know, went to trial, of course, and they deemed him, you know, kind of like the insanity plea. I mean, it was not his fault. It was like he did it while he was sleeping, and they didn't want him to go to jail and pay for this thing. He was in enough pain, you know, having done this to his wife. As it was like it was just hell. I mean, it's probably still hell for him to wake up every day knowing that he's done that. And so this whole concept of having something like that burdening you that isn't really your fault, but carrying around this extreme guilt from something that you've done because of, you know, I mean, this has got to be worse than even, you know, drunk driving and hitting somebody. You know, this is even, at least you can feel guilty appropriately, like you were drunk, you know, if you did that. But with sleep, you can't even really have you're guilty, but you can't even realize you've done something wrong because you didn't do anything intentionally wrong other than maybe try and stop a demon in your sleep. And so that whole concept fascinated me, and I decided to burden one of my characters with this type of situation. She doesn't strangle anybody or anything like that, but you'll have to read to find out what she has done in her life. But I'm going to read a little bit of her. Most of my books give you a sense of Montana right off the bat, and this doesn't because it kind of deals with the sleep thing a little bit. However, as you can see by the cover, the fires are going on, and a couple years ago, the fires were pretty bad up in my area. I can't remember if they were bad here in Bozeman, and it would have been 2015, 2014. Yeah, you had the smoke, and and you probably got ours too, yeah. And so, you'll get a sense of that. Gretchen, chapter 1. I'd love to tell you the person I am now has nothing to do with the girl I was when I lived in Sandefjord, a quaint port town on the southern tip of Norway. I was born there, a place where the sun glinting on the navy-colored, foamy bay made you feel alive, and the crisp air gusting in from the North Sea ensured you never forgot your strong-blooded Nordic roots. I lived a typical, healthy life with my family, skiing, sledding, skating, until everyone, my mother, my father, my grandparents, my aunts and uncles, the neighbors, my classmates, my teachers, quit trusting me. I quit trusting me. It had been exactly 5 years and 2 months since the last time I had gone through a phase of my dreaded sleepwalking habit when I was 25. I have had what professionals call a REM behavior disorder, a condition that takes sleepwalking to absurd levels since I was a child. Unlike most people who frame each day with an awakening from sleep and a submission back into it, I learned that the bracket on the slumbering end of my frame was seriously flawed. After a busy or stressful day when most people relish the thought of snuggling into their beds, wrapped in warm covers, their heads sinking into soft pillows and sliding blissfully into a world of dreams where time ceases to exist, I fear going to sleep, sometimes dread it. But I had begun to think I might be over my syndrome, that I'd succeeded in prying myself away from my younger self, that treacherous girl, like I was a toy comprised of two plastic parts held together only by stubborn glue. Unfortunately, I was wrong, and my disorder began rearing its ugly head again one warm summer morning in August. Later, my doctor would say it was the heat and the particle-filled air that acted as a trigger, but I came to see its resurfacing as much more faded, a deeper prompt forcing me to dredge up raw, unwelcome memories. I woke up at my usual 6 a.m. alarm and noticed the light covers, a sheet and thin blanket tangled and pushed to the bottom of the bed. I gave myself the benefit of the doubt. After all, it had been a hot night. All summer, the temperature had hovered upward of 95 degrees, and half the Northwest was on fire. Montana was no exception. Fires burn to the east, west, north, and south of the Flathead Valley, and the ones raging in and around Glacier National Park had started more than 4 weeks earlier. Now the thick smoke blanketed the mountains and choked the valley, making each day feel like an apocalyptic event lurked around the corner. I'd closed the windows the night before because it seemed better to suffer the heat than to inhale the dense, toxic air. A fly had furiously buzzed along the windowsill, captive in the stagnant room. For a good half hour, I listened to its maddening buzz and its random, annoying flights. After I tried to swat at it when it flew too close to my face a number of times, it settled somewhere on the ash-covered sill and left me alone. I finally drifted off, listening to the whir of the ceiling fan. Of course, I thought, such circumstances would give anyone a restless night. I'd probably just kick the covers down to get some air. I swung my feet to the wood plank floor, pleased to feel the smooth slats under my soles, and sat for a second rubbing my arms. The morning light filtered through the smoky sky and stretched across the golden floor like gauze, turning it a sickly yellowish orange. I looked out the window, hopelessly wanting to see something wet. Some freshly soaked pavement, leaves dripping with moisture, or soil darkened by rain. It was bone dry. The grass in the small yard turned beige, the leaves on the tips of the brushes tinged yellow. The pine trees in the sidewoods appeared diseased with reddish-brown needles, many already fallen and desiccated on the forest floor as if it were fall. There was no relief in the forecast. I picked up my phone from the bedside table and checked for messages. There were none, so I headed to the bathroom to shower and get ready to go into the lab. Nothing too pressing was going on, but I needed to finish some paperwork on a deceased man, a young firefighter, in fact, from the day before. He'd been found separated from his crew, sitting still against a tree if he were simply enjoying a peaceful moment in the forest, watching swallows diving in and out of branches or listening to the chickadees sing their songs before continuing on his way. Only in these fire-infested woods, there would be no birdsong. The ME determined that it was his heart, an arrhythmia, but we'd been called in before the ME made that determination, just in case there was foul play. I'd almost forgotten about my bed covers when I looked in the mirror one last time, checking that my shoulder-length blonde hair was secured neatly away from my face, and the small amount of blush I'd applied wasn't on too thick. Not out of vanity. I just hated too much makeup. My fair skin didn't take it well, so I picked up a tissue and gently wiped my cheekbones to dab up any excess color and lighten the effect of the already faint pink powder. There were certain things you picked up from your mother, whether you wanted to or not, and I could still hear her words, Amerikanska jenterbruker för mig sminka. American girls wear too much makeup. After moving to Seattle from Norway at age 18, I went for months painting on as much cover-up and thick mascara as possible just to separate myself from the au naturel Nordic girl that my family knew, just to ensure that when I looked in the mirror, I could almost pretend I was Amerikansk and not notice the ghostly, nearly translucent skin and the treacherous blue eyes staring back, constantly questioning who I was and why the hell I was alive. Eventually, I couldn't fight reality anymore and gave up one day. After looking at myself and realizing I loathed the disguise just as much as I hated the girl underneath the raccoon liner, deep rosy blush, and mauve lipstick. That was the last time I wore heavy makeup. I threw the tissue in the trash and headed to the kitchen to make some coffee. When I stepped into the living room, I stopped immediately. The shelves on the other side of the room stood vacant except for two cast iron book weights formed in the shape of easy chairs. My books weren't there. All of them, probably 50, paperbacks, hardbacks, all of my forensic texts, had been taken down. Instead, four rows of stacked books, each slightly crooked rows and columns before the fireplace. I glanced at my small dining room off to my right. Two dining chairs stood peculiarly on top of the oak table. What else had I done? I, of course, considered whether I had left the house or not, perhaps walked down the street in my underwear in the middle of the night, maybe peed on some of the neighbor's bushes. But even though I work in forensics, it doesn't take a super sleuth to check out the scene. I had taken a look around, filled in a few blanks, and discerned I'd done nothing crazy. All my doors were locked, my key still hidden in its jar above the refrigerator, unmoved since I'd set it there before going to bed. My doors require keys for both entering and leaving. Since I'm not particularly tall, no more than 5'4", I would have had to have grabbed either a chair or my footstool to reach above the refrigerator. All signs indicated that I'd only set the two chairs on the dining table and not messed with the other two. This I could also tell by a slight film of dust that had collected on the floor, since I hadn't eaten at my dining room table in months. And my footstool with its worn red, blue, and gold embroidered flowers and wooden lion's feet was exactly where I'd left it, near my closet in the bedroom with a pile of dirty clothes draped across it. When I purchased the house, the locksmiths thought I was crazy for wanting keys that work both ways, but as I mentioned, I don't trust myself, not since I was exactly 15 years and 3 months old. My parents used to try to convince me that there were plenty of people in the same boat, those who felt like they couldn't maintain control at certain times, alcoholics, drug addicts, people with anger management issues. But my issue was different because I had always been fine during my waking moments. It was the nighttime that posed problems. Besides, I could see in their worried expressions, their furrowed brows and tear-filled eyes, that they didn't entirely believe the logic themselves, especially my mom. She wanted to, but ultimately, she couldn't. No one predicted that something as innocent as sleep could be lethal for me, for my family. I pushed down the sickening feeling that rose inside of me. I marched over, grabbed each chair, and scooted it back under the table where it belonged. "Shit," I mumbled out to no one. "Herbal tea," I thought, "something without caffeine. I need herbal tea before I put away those damn books." So Keith and I both like to just do the question thing, and so if anybody has questions...
So his question is, does Penguin want me to write more fishing scenes or fewer? I don't think they care at this point, but it's a really strange thing because you've got to walk this tightrope where I can't write down to people who know stuff, but the majority of my readers are people of both sexes of a certain age, we shall say, and they have no interest in fishing. So I've got to sort of walk that line. So one thing I want to do is I just wanted to recognize a few people in the audience here. I talk to an awful lot of people, but I very seldom talk to people who are actually characters in my books. So my wife, Gail Schonsler, she is the intrepid reporter Gail Stalker in the books for the Bridger Mountain Star. My good friend Bob Bullock sitting here with his son, Bo. That's the Bullock and Bullock Detective Agency, father and son. They're not very good. Joel Ellison is over there. I actually have one of his knives in my books, right? And Arnie Dude, last but not least, is back there. He was the bison specialist for Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, and he is my Theodore Roosevelt character in Buffalo Jump Blues, and one of the best guys we have in the business, I think. And the other person is Valerie Hemingway, who I have not yet put in the book, because I can't really do her justice. She's from Dublin, and she's got that accent, and she's one of the most fascinating people I've ever met without the Hemingway connection. Just so anyway, my aspiration is to get good enough to put her in a book, too. Well, you know that they say, well, when does that empty nest syndrome kick in? Well, for me, it did the day my youngest child went to college. I came back home, and, I had a cat. I don't know what else I had at that point, but... the house was just too quiet, so I started working anywhere but that, but there. So I started working in coffee shops, which I do. And then in the summer, I really like to work outside, so especially the little covered bridge at the Drinking Horse Mountain Trail. That's my favorite place, and other places. Basically, I want to put myself in prison where I can't get internet access or email.
She was just mentioning that Keith has one character through the entire series, and I like to switch it up a little, and so she was just asking about that and if I thought I might settle on one. And so far, I did not mention that in my second book, which features a guy named Monty Harris, I have him in this book as well. So right after that chapter that I finished reading, I go to his point of view. And so I have continued him into this book. I thought maybe I'd be done with him, but I left this little tiny kind of thing hanging on with him that I felt like I needed to continue with. And so he's still, he's in this book as well. And for the fourth book I'm writing now, I have, there's an FBI agent who works in the resident office in Kalispell, and she's my main character in the book I'm currently working on right now. And I've also got two points of view for this book, but it doesn't feature anybody else from here. But Monty does reoccur, so it's not out of the question at all that I think I could continue on with somebody, especially if I didn't feel like I was done with them.
Well, what am I reading right now? I just finished a really good book, but I can't remember what it was. See, I sort of have a reading disability. I actually do. If I try to read a novel, even like my own, I just skip the pages and just read a sentence or two and skip around and read a sentence or two. And after 4 or 5 days, I'd challenge anybody to find a page or find a sentence I haven't read. I've read them all, but in no particular sequence. And it's not like I'm some kind of idiot savant. I have no comprehension of them. So I go way back. You know, I was very impressed by the Sherlock Holmes series. When I was like 7 years old, I had the complete Sherlock Holmes. It was like that thick. I still have it. And he was my first inspiration. And then my favorite writer besides that was Jim Corbett, the guy who hunted man-eating tigers in India. And I eventually got to follow in his footsteps there. He actually did more to save the tiger, I think, than anybody except Indira Gandhi. And then I was also very impressed with Ernest Hemingway, F. Scott Fitzgerald, the people of that generation. I sort of seemed to never sort of get beyond that. And the other person was Al McLean, who was the fishing editor of Field and Stream, was also a very fine book writer. And he was the person that I wanted to be. I wanted to take his job. I tell people I wanted to meet Al McLean and impress him. I wanted to marry his daughter, who was a very beautiful young woman my age. And I wanted to take his job at Field and Stream. And I never did any of those things, but I sort of came close in a way.
You know, those first two books my practice books that I mentioned earlier, those were not in the first person. And somehow I made that switch when I decided to enter the world of crime fiction. And I think I just decided that it would be more interesting for me to be in the head of my characters, especially if they were dealing with past issues as well as trying to investigate the current case, and that I just felt that it would be better to be uptight and close to that. Not that you can't do that in third person, because you can. You can still be very close and in their head, obviously, almost to the same degree. I mean, I don't think there's a huge difference in terms of being able to reveal what's personally going on with somebody between the first and the third, but it's a really great question. I think it's one of those things that, for me, that to go back to quote, one step at a time, I think I just took that step, first person, and it felt right, and that's what I did. It wasn't so much of a really educated, I'm not going to do this because of A, B, and C, and D. I mean, it was more just that felt right, I took that step, and that's where I headed.
Yeah, that was sort of like me, is like no thought process involved. When I wrote for Field & Stream magazine and a lot of other magazines, I always wrote in first person. And so I assumed if I wrote a book, I would also be in first person. And then I started to write The Royal Wolf Murders, and I started it off in third person. So I didn't plan that. I'd still like to write in first person the best. But, you know, I have a couple co-main characters. And I write in sort of a modified third person in that I don't try to get into the heads of everybody else, so they don't all have equal weight. So my first two people, Martha and Sean, we only sort of see things through their eyes. And if they're in the same scene together, whichever one's more important in that scene, that's whose eyes we see it through. And those are the things, but it's just a learning process as you go. But I still prefer first person for most things. It's more natural and is faster, but I haven't done it for a while. So anyway.
there are definitely some pitfalls with it. I mean, you know, when you, like, especially the information dump at the end of a crime novel, because you know you're in your head and only your head, and so you can't just dive into your criminal's head and go, okay, like a lot of thrillers, you know, you get the criminal's perspective as well, and so you already know why, you know, all along why they've done something, or you're informed. But when you're only in your head, you literally you can only find out from what's going on through your own detective work, and then backstory has to be filled in somehow. And sometimes you have this long interview or information dump where the person is telling you why they've done it, and you have to try and make it realistic. So. Yeah.